Joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is Dr. Karen Cox. She is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and she is giving the second annual Gilbo Lecture this evening at 6 o'clock in Griffin Hall in the auditorium. The Gilbo Lecture Series was funded by the Gilbo Charitable Trust, and we're all very proud of that lecture series here at the university, and very glad that they're bringing in people like yourself to give lectures, interesting perspectives, and just the fact that we're inviting notable scholars from other places to our campus is what the Gilbo Fund is all about. So welcome to our campus. The title of your talk this evening, again at 6 o'clock in Griffin, is Confederate Monuments in the Jim Crow South. You are widely published. You also work for quite a number of newspapers, magazines. You write for them. You've appeared on NPR before. So you work very hard, not only at your university, but in getting the word out about your scholarship and the work you've been doing. So tell us just a bit about that, what your particular focus of history is, and then we'll talk more about the lecture tonight.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me here, and I'm really pleased to be here in Lafayette. I don't want to mispronounce that, and that bothers people. So my area of expertise is Southern history and culture. And I've been teaching at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, for almost 16 years. I got my PhD at the University of Southern Mississippi, and it's there where I wrote a dissertation on the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which led me into researching and writing about the whole the monument period in the early 20th century, about when they were put up and how the money was raised and what they said about them and things like that. And that book came out several years ago. It'll be 15 years old this spring.
You won prizes and accolades for that book.
But when I wrote it, though, it was just like another dissertation in Southern history. But after the uprising in Charlottesville, I was motivated to write about monuments in general for a broader public. And I've been trying to do that all along with anything I do. I try to write for the public. And I just knew something different was going on there. And I wanted to be put that in historical context and perspective to help people understand what those monuments were about. And so it's led to other writing projects, a lot of speaking invitations, including this one. And it's an ongoing discussion, not just here, but around the South.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to give away your whole lecture this evening, but I think, there are obviously a lot of emotional responses to your topic. And we have a great program called Bayou to Beltway here at the station that has addressed some of those issues having to do particularly with Lafayette. But give us a sense of the history of it, because I think a lot of us simply don't. No, and when you talk about the early part of the 20th century, I think you have a lot of people going, well, wait, when did those monuments go up?
Right. So there are different phases, and I'm going to be discussing that tonight from the period immediately after the war through the late 19th century through, and then another push in the early 20th century, and then there will be a lull, and then there will be another round of monument building in the 50s and 60s.
Just one period when they were all put up.
Right. Yeah. But the peak period is between 1890 and 1920. And the reason for that is pretty simple. It's the United Daughters of the Confederacy. I mean, they were just a powerhouse organization and great at fundraising. And this was one of their objectives, was to build monuments. And they were very successful at doing so. And so they were founded in 1894. And between that time and World War I, then is when you see the expansion of this monument phase of building. It really peaks during that period. And so that's pretty much what we, you know, that's been documented really well.
Mm-hmm. So how do you approach that? As you said, you're trying to write for the greater public, general public. How do you go about trying to help us understand what the issues are? What is your particular focus and method of doing that?
Well, one is to write in a language that people understand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The second is to basically be plain spoken about it. So this was the period of time when these were erected. These were the people involved. This was what was driving it, these kinds of things. And so I want people to understand, you know, I think people get upset because they think this is I'm lashing out at their ancestors or something like that. What I'm trying to help people understand is this is a moment in history. And in the South, frankly, everybody was a white supremacist if you were white. That's just the truth. You believed in a racial hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You just did, mm-hmm. you know, and that wouldn't have been unusual. So to put those monuments up when they were put up, you know, it just wouldn't have been unusual for there to be that connection. While I know, you know, which I want to try to make this evening, I just want to try to do it in a way that's like help people understand and illustrate that as best I can, not only with photographs and charts, but also, you know, with primary sources. I do have documents, and if you read my book on the United Daughters of the Confederacy, obviously I don't come to my talks with a stack of primary sources, but if you read my book, it is very well documented, and there are quotes from the minutes of the meeting, from speeches, from the Confederate Veteran magazine. And on and on.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the response? Your book, Dixie's Daughters, was published in the early 2000s. And as you said, at that point, a lot of these uprisings hadn't happened. It was a little quieter period about the monuments and the work of the Daughters of the Confederacy. What has been the response, the difference in response then and what you get now when you give talks?
Well, it's usually – now, I will say in 2004, there was a little blow-up at Vanderbilt University when they tried to remove Confederate from Confederate Memorial Hall because the United Daughters of the Confederacy had built that, had raised the money and put that dorm there. And they actually – the UDC is in the years since has won that argument because they had a contract. But at the time, I was asked to come in and give some context. Well, Vanderbilt was getting lots of mail, lots of phone calls, and even death threats and bomb threats. And so the first when I was arrived there, there were, you know, undercover police in the audience. I'd never experienced anything like that. But that was really unusual. And so most of the time, though, other than that, it's only when there's a sense that something might be taken away that mm-hmm. people get really upset. I think that for the most part, they're not even paying any attention to the fact that there's that monument down the street. But mostly when I talked, and it may be the way I've spoken about it, I try to give sort of an overview of what that organization was, who joined the organization, what they were about, what they said they were about, and that sort of thing. And so it never really got into sort of the, you know, the tension has certainly been raised since Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. And so I've started writing about it differently and speaking about it differently because I felt like that's something I needed to do.
Do you find when you go, and I'm sure you've given talks all over the South on this topic, not just Vanderbilt, do you find that you research particular monuments that may be in the community where you're going, or do you not delve into that?
Sometimes I do, mm-hmm. or I illustrate one that's you know, local or something along those lines. Now, I've been asked about the Mouton Monument. Mm-hmm. I have not had the time to do the research on the Mouton Monument. I know that some students here have done some research, and I think that's what it requires, that people research it and try to understand it and understand how the money was raised, understand, you know, the rituals that went along with the unveiling and all of those things. And the way it's been used since then. And when you think about this, you know, if we think about South Carolina, for example, at the state capitol, where they, you know, after the murder of 9 parishioners in Mother Emanuel Church, the governor decided that they were going to take down the Confederate flag. They didn't take down the monument, and the monument is still there. And it is exactly the place where, you know, groups of people who, you know, of, you know, white heritage groups, Southern heritage groups, like to gather around when they have a beef about their heritage. And so they're there with their battle flags, et cetera, you know, basically to put up a fight. And so in that way, those monuments are still being used in the 21st century around issues of race. They just simply are. And you can't separate those out. You can't just think about this as some innocuous monument that hasn't meant something to these people and hasn't meant something to the black community. You know, it's nice to say this is about our heritage, but then you ignore the fact that, you know, your heritage also includes slavery. Your heritage also includes racial violence. Your heritage also includes lynching. Your heritage is very problematic in some ways. That's not to say that people are bad people, but in the context of the period in which these things have existed, again, like I said earlier, it wouldn't be unusual for anyone in the white community to think that they belong to a hierarchy of race in which they were superior to the black people around them.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to go very far into your own community if you look at newspapers that were written at that time, 1900, 1910, exactly the time period you're talking about. And we don't see those. Those are back in archives, you know, and so it's easy to maybe make up a new story. But as you say, it's once you go back, you do see that rhetoric. And as you say, you're very plain spoken and you present the facts and you try to help people to understand the history. But what are some of the truly, I guess, more difficult and nuanced questions you've had to deal with? I mean, there must be, you know, people who do come with some very deep concerns who haven't perhaps thought about it in the way you have. Have you been confronted with that?
Nothing that I felt was, you know, particularly difficult. Mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. They consistently are the same, and it doesn't matter where. Mm-hmm. This is about, you know, you're going to erase history, or mm-hmm. you're going to erase, you know, erase my heritage, or mm-hmm. or something along those lines.
Disrespecting my great grandfather,
right, mm-hmm. or something, or you know that I'm picking on these ladies mm-hmm. in the UDC. You know, they were just, you know, mourning widows and et cetera that were just trying to honor their, you know, the men in their family. Mm-hmm. That'd be true if it was, you know, 1865 or 1866, but not in 1910.
40 years later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
50 years later. If you are just tuning in, my guest is Dr. Karen Cox. She is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. She is here to give the second annual Gilbo Lecture this evening at 6 o'clock in Griffin Hall, room 147. The title of her talk is Confederate Monuments in the Jim Crow South. We have an extremely active history department here at UL Lafayette. As you heard Dr. Cox mention, there is a group of students in the history department who have been looking at the particular history of our area. I don't know if they're going to be there tonight or they will present anything tonight. No, but I guess there's a question and answer period afterwards, and
there will be.
Those students will be there to add any information that they may wish to give.
If they want to step up.
If they want to, that's right. That's right. And we not only have a great history department, but public history is really important to them.
It's very important here. It's a stellar program. I had lunch with some of the students today. They're outstanding. I expect them all to get jobs. And I, you know, it's very impressive, mm-hmm. really, what they do here with public history.
Yeah, they've been extremely creative in the ways that they are trying to get that information out. You know, having a little museum on the go. They've done apps where people can take tours, art tours, monument tours, history tours. I think they did this pretty amazing app that they started after 12 Years a Slave. where you could actually go around and you had a map of all of the different sites in Louisiana. So very good professors, very creative. And I know the students, if I've had an opportunity to talk to them, are very well trained. And in large part, it is the efforts of the community and the professors to bring people in like yourself who give a well-grounded, bigger perspective in history. So we really appreciate the fact that you are here. The Confederate monuments in the Jim Crow South, I think some people may think they may have a very narrow view of what Jim Crow, what that time period is. Mm-hmm. When you talk about it, what are the dates you're talking about? Anything after the Civil War? I think some people think maybe, 30s, 40s.
We could talk. We could begin discussing this, you know, around 1890s. Okay. This is the same period because it's the period of when if we take, say, 1890, what was called the Mississippi Plan, which was passed in that state in order to disenfranchise black men who had been given the vote, you know, with these Reconstruction Amendments. So they were trying to basically roll back those Reconstruction Amendments and the citizenship that came with it. And so that began there. And then state after state adopted the Mississippi Plan, which then meant by 1900, mainly black men had been disenfranchised. So they weren't allowed to elect anybody that looked like them to office. And then, you know, Jim Crow is two parts. It's de jure and, you know, de facto. So it's by law and it's just by custom. And so that segregation has existed in, you know, in whether it's in housing, whether it's, you know, in public transportation or, you know, and then it was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1896 by Plessy versus Ferguson. And so the Supreme Court assisted the South in maintaining legal segregation and also basically, you know, people across the country, even Northerners, and I don't give Northerners a pass, by the way. I don't give Northern whites a pass. They're as racist as the next group. They turned their back on a war that they fought to emancipate 4 million slaves from. So they, you know, and so in, as a, they were more interested in reconciliation with the South, more interested in, and basically out of capitalist greed, honestly. I mean, they wanted to be able to restore a relationship with the South for economic purposes. And so they could turn their back on the real ugly parts of, you know, of what was going on in the South during the same period, 1890 to 1920, when there was an increase in the number of lynchings, increases in racial violence, et cetera.
That is fascinating, and that is why we need historians like yourself, because we don't know. We're not going back through those books, and we don't remember. Those are not stories that are passed down in families, the laws and the changes that you're talking about. So we will all be the more informed after your lecture this evening. I know it's open to everyone. The History Department hopes that lots of people come out to hear your talk and have a conversation about it afterwards. 6 o'clock, at Griffin Hall, lots of room in Griffin Hall, quite a number of seats in there. And it's a little easier parking at nighttime. There is a parking garage very close to Griffin Hall. So if you're concerned about that, you just go in the parking garage and Griffin Hall is just one building over. So it's easy to get to campus that way. Lots going on, but this certainly is a worthy event to be attending here on the UL campus, which offers so much to our community. Again, my guest, Dr. Karen Cox, is here to give the second annual Gilbo Lecture, a lecture series that was funded by the Gilbo Charitable Trust, and we're all grateful to them as well. 6 o'clock tonight, again, all invited. Thanks so much.
Thank you.